The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. Here's round one to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words approximately right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what's the meaning of discarnate? D-I-S-C-A-R-N-A-T-E, discarnate.
Anything to do with flesh?
Yeah.
Well, the dis part of it means separating.
Yes.
Is it with the flesh off the bones?
Yes.
Hmm? Oh, with the flesh off the bone.
2 marks, well done. Fought your way through. It means stripped of or parted from the flesh or disembodied, and it's exactly opposite of incarnate, which means made flesh.
But the ultimate in strip, that is. Take the flesh off as well.
Like very exiguous indeed.
Like Sidney Smith's remark when it was very hot. He said, I feel like taking off my skin and just sitting in my bones.
That's exactly the adjective for that, Frank. Absolutely right. Now Frank Muir himself. Frank, what is a pyrometer? P-Y-R and ometer.
It's a measuring device.
Yes.
Which dentists use.
Measuring what?
Pyrrhea.
No, that won't do.
Pie. Pie could be to measure. Could be a simple caliper to make sure the pie will go in the oven. We think it's something to do with fire, Jack.
Yes.
It measures what? Fire.
Or heat.
Why do you want to measure fire?
I don't personally. Take it for granted. It's a measures the heat of fire.
Yes, I think that's good enough.
A heat measurer.
A heat measurer, that's what I wanted. It's an instrument for measuring temperature, but temperatures that in the main are too high for you to use an ordinary mercury thermometer, which would just blow up. So you have this thing called a pyrometer instead. Dillis Powell, what is Billingsgate? And I don't mean the market itself.
It's a form of language.
What kind of language?
Low.
Now, how's it come to mean there?
Well, I always imagine it was because people at Billingsgate spoke rather roughly to one another.
Yes, that'll do it in 2 marks. Means, normally, violent abuse. Said to have been coined as the result of rather more serious types listening to fish women in the Billingsgate market. I'm sure this is an absolute libel on the Billingsgate fish woman, but there it is. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is poco curante?
I guess you get a productivity bonus for foreign words. It's Italian.
Yes.
And it's what Italians say when they're indifferent.
Mm-hmm.
It means little caring.
Yes.
Or I couldn't care less, or blow you Giacomo.
Alto bene.
A completely accurate and most illustrative description. 2 marks. Well done. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I hope the two women members of the teams will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme I shall ask them where the quotations come from.
I'll see that Anne goes on studying hers, Jack.
Keep me to it, yes.
Well, Anne's is, Anne, Scott James and Dennis Norden, here's your quotation. Honesty is the best policy. And Dennis Power and Frank Muir, yours is Bonnie and Clyde.
We know that.
Well, then, in the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round two is the Department of Odds and Ends. 2 marks for correct answers. Anne Scott James, who and what was Jonathan Wilde?
Jonathan Wilde was the hero of a book.
Yes.
Written in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
By, now, Smollett, Stern,
Fielding.
Yes. Fielding, I think.
Yes, that's right. And what sort of chap?
Oh, wild.
Yes, I'd like a little more about him.
Bad hat.
Who had a gang.
Yeah, get it. Yeah. All right, that's 2 marks. He was a thoroughly notorious rogue, and he did, in fact, live between 1680 and around 1725, and he became the head of a very large gang of thieves and other kinds of crooks, took most of their booty, and kept himself for a long time clear of the law by denouncing any of his gang who contested his authority. And so he got a reputation as taking thieves and on behalf of the law, but eventually was found out and was hanged at Tyburn. And as Anne quite rightly says, Fielding wrote a satirical romance about him called Jonathan Wilde the Great, but also he had his life written by Defoe, who's another person Anne didn't mention, but 2 marks. Frank Muir, who was Fra Diavolo?
He's a monk.
No.
Oh. He was a brother. He was a devil.
That is true, yes, in a sense. Yes.
I'm running out of ideas.
In an opera.
He's an opera, yeah.
In an opera.
Yes, he was in an opera.
He was an opera.
Mm-hmm.
He was a mystical character to describe.
Yes, he is.
Difficult character to get hold of.
I don't think you're going to
prose.
Give him. But I'll give you one for knowing what the name meant, which means brother devil, and for knowing that he is the subject of an opera by Auber, which bears the same name. But he was a real chap. He was an Italian brigand. His real name was Michele Pezza. He lived at the end of the 18th century, leader of a troop of brigands, and they had something to do with trying to free South Italy from the French. And he became a thoroughly popular character, but in the end he was arrested and he was shot. And that's roughly what the opera is about. 1 out of 2. Dennis Powell, who was Moll Flanders?
Moll Flanders was the heroine of a novel by Defoe.
Yes.
She was a thief and lived sort of round about Billingsgate. And she really fell into evil ways and stole some cloth.
Yes, I think that's about enough. 2 marks it is. Defoe wrote The Fortunes and Misfortunes of the Famous Moll Flanders, and she was the heroine. The girl had her mother transported to Virginia when she was very young because the mother was a thief, and the story tells most terrible things about her seduction, about her various marriages and other things which weren't marriages, and the way she went to Virginia, where she found her mother and found that she'd inadvertently married her own brother. I don't mean the mother, I mean Moll. She then came back to England, was a very successful pickpocket, and she then married a highwayman, and they were both transported back to Virginia, which is a bit odd, and they finished up as planters with all the money that they'd stolen, and their remaining years ended in penitence and prosperity. Dennis Norton, what do you know about Mary Celeste?
We're just good friends. Mary Celeste was a sailing ship round about the end of the last century.
Yes.
Which was found afloat with dinner warm in the oven and on the table, but nobody aboard. What could have happened? We once advanced a theory, Frank and I, which I escapes me whether it was actually original, but the idea was that they were all having dinner, and the captain said, let's all go on deck and I'll take a photograph. So he had the crew on deck, and he said, pointed to the camera, said, no, back a bit.
Well, that's about the most probable explanation ever arrived at for one of the greatest mysteries of the sea. This was an American brig, and she was on her way from New York to Genoa and was picked up by a British ship on the 5th of December, 1872, as Dennis says, in absolutely perfect condition and obviously recently occupied, but completely deserted. The ship's boats were missing, and nobody has ever found out since what the fate of the crew was. Well, now I have a round of origins and derivations, and I can award up to 3 marks if members of the teams can first of all define the present meaning and then give me the origin or derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Hanscott James, the florin.
Well, what it means now,
mm-hmm,
means a 2-shilling piece.
It's about, yes, tenpence.
But by origin, and why so called?
Oh, well, I think it derives from the Italian word florino, which was an early 12th century coin with a flower minted on it.
Yes, quite right. Yes. It was first introduced in this country in 1849 as the very beginnings of decimal coinage as a tenth of the pound. They didn't go on with that for quite a long time. But the earliest of all in this country were 6 and 8, and were introduced in 1337 by Edward III, and they were called originally in this country godly florins because they left out, perhaps because of the size of the coin, the letters DG, which means by God's grace, and also FD, which is defender of the faith. Three marks it is. Frank Muir, echo.
Well, you say, hello! And think, ooh. It's when your voice is hurled back at you by mountains or rooms or the bathroom ceiling or something.
Yes.
It's an echo. It comes from Greek mythology, does it not? Is it not? And Echo is a lady.
Yes.
She displeased somebody.
Yes.
And as punishment, she could only repeat what people said.
Yes, good enough.
That's all I know.
Three marks it is.
Later died.
She was an attendant on the queen of the goddesses, Hera, and Hera got very cross with her because she kept on chattering while Hera was trying to surprise her husband Zeus, who was among the nymphs at that particular point of time. And so she was punished by not being allowed to speak except repeating words said to her by other people. Later, poor girl, she fell in love with Narcissus, who wasn't interested, and she pined away and died, and only her echoing voice was left behind. Dennis Powell, amnesty. A-M-N-E-S-T-Y, amnesty.
Amnesty means a kind of forgiveness, a kind of truce. And, if you're under sentence of death, you won't be hanged or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And what's it come from?
Not remembering something.
Yes. Amnesty is an official pardon, intentionally overlooking crime or offences you've committed. And it means, as Dillis says, rather like amnesia, which is a loss of memory, a forgetting. And it's supposed to have been first used by a Greek general who said he would forgive his enemies and not remember their misdeeds. And so this word was made up, meaning not remembering. Dennis Norden, melancholy.
Well, it means depression, glumness. And the origin slowly being written down for me.
Black bile?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, really.
Oh. Well, I'm merely telling you, Jack, as I got it, you know. Black bile.
Yes, well, that's right.
The whole art of this game is, when you get absolutely right, is to look as though you meant it from the start. Yes, of course it's black.
Can you, between you, say why?
Well, yes, because there was a sort of old-fashioned idea in medicine that black bile caused you to be sad.
Yes.
Probably something in it.
Yep, three marks it is.
Hence the anatomy of melancholy.
That's it. Yes. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. Two marks and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Honesty is the best policy.
I've been wondering chiefly whether I really agree with it or not. I think I don't. I think it's a rather phony proverb, old proverb.
I think it's both traditional and a non. I don't think it can be traced to any particular source. It turns up in England in the 16th century, maybe from other countries before that. Honesty is the best policy. Well, now, Dennis Powell, can I have the origin of your quotation, Bonnie and Clyde?
Well, it's the title of a film made by Arthur Penn in colour, which concerns the adventures of two, as I think, perfectly despicable young Americans who murdered, without any provocation, a lot of perfectly harmless people.
Yes.
And there's a song about them. I disapprove.
Very moral comment.
Yes.
Two marks it is. And now I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so back to Dennis Norden with honesty is the best policy.
When you come right down to it, the world is divided into two sorts of people. The sort of people who say that the world is divided into two sorts of people, and the sort of people who don't say that the world is divided into two sorts of people. But why I make this rather profound generalization is because I was with, some time ago, with an American who was the first type of person. He divided the world into people who are what he calls losers and people who are not what he calls losers. Now, this use of the American word losers I found absolutely fascinating, because they use it with an absolute finality. They will label a person a loser. I said to him, what do you mean by a loser? And he said, a loser is a person who, by reason of some inherent defect, cannot possibly finally succeed in the vocation he has set himself out for. I said, well, give me an example. He said, well, a deaf lumberjack. A little bit of thinking and you get that picture. Timber! Beg your pardon? This whole concept, what you might call the loser concept, began to fascinate me. And I met, on a bus, I met a loser. He was sitting next to me. We got chatting. And I said, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a flagpole salesman. Now, classic case. If you think, out of all the possible professions in contemporary England, which you are bound to be a loser, a flagpole salesman. And I said, how's things? He said, it couldn't be worse. He said, I've got these flagpoles in my basement. He said, you know that thing, patriotism is not enough. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a darn sight too much. He said, you can't get rid of flagpoles today? He said, I've tried other fields. He said, they're too long for telegraph poles, too wide for goalposts. Took him to the Highland Games. Oh, no, you can. A caber is a caber and a flagpole, you know. He was sort of gallant in his way, this chap, you know, sitting there reading an Evelyn Waugh book. That made it worse. Put out more flags. He wasn't kind of sorry for himself. You know, when he got up to go, he said, oh, well, soldier on, you know. And he went down as a loser, you know, but with a kind of heroic quality. You know, anybody looks heroic trying to take a flagpole down the steps of a bus, but there was something special about this bloke, and I went to the trouble of following up to see what happened to him. And he did lose. He had to send 3,000 flagpoles that he had in all his stock to a sawmill and got them sawn down and sent for export to American golf courses. Next time you watch Championship Golf on television, you see that little stick by the side of the hole that holds the number. Just think to yourself, that was part of something that once held the Union Jack. And reflect, as you see the golfer, the American golfer, drive off, reflect where all the flagpoles went. And think to yourself, on his tee is the best pole I see.
Dennis's story nearly burst me into tears. So we go on quickly to Frank Muir, And if you remember, his quotation was Bonnie and Clyde.
The other evening, after a good dinner, my home, of course, ladies left us. My friends and I were sitting over our pipes. It was a cold night, and they asked... And one of them, I forget which, said to me, Cynthia... I remember, it was a short-sighted one, yes. He said, Cynthia, when does one grow up? Looking back over your childhood, when did you leave your childhood, become a person? I sat there for a moment, numbed. I was on the icy bit anyway, but turning it over in my mind, and I recalled, as lines of poetry, alas that spring should vanish with the rose, and youth's sweet manuscript should close. Lines translated from a Persian poet by that very wise Jewish lady, Olma Cohen. I reflected that lovely line, youth sweet, besides being unsayable on the air, is also, when does youth's sweet manuscript close and manhood's dog-eared paperback open? Was it the moment when, instead of rushing for a raspberry aid with an ice cream in it, one suddenly realizes that a glass of bitter does the job much? Then that's really going into puberty. That's another thing entirely. It is a development. But I think the change really is the change in taste in music, because all my childhood memories are to do with music. And the most potent memory of all was, my favourite song was Max Welton Brazier, Bonnie, When Early Falls the Dew, because I had it on a portable gramophone. Some of you may remember those. We sat on the beach in the sun and the records warped and the sand went and the record belted round and this rather wobbly tenor sang, and for Bonnie and Bonnie Laurie I would lay me down under the sea. I thought this was the most beautiful song, because I'd fallen in love. I was about 11 at the time, and I fell in love with a girl I never spoke to. She had blonde hair. She was about 8. She was quite beautiful. And this was a girl. And I heard this record, and I fell in love with this girl. And ever since, I thought, how wonderful. And for Bonnie Annie Laurie, I'd lay me down and D. And I wanted to D for this lovely girl, and it's absolutely marvellous. And all the other chaps were singing all the latest songs like, I'm an airman, and I fly, 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 and terribly virile ones like Constantinople, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-T-I-N-O-P-L. And they were singing songs like, all I wanted to hear was, and for body, 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 I'd lay me down to thee. And one day, about 4 years later, I suddenly saw a brunette girl. And I put this record, my beloved Annie Laurie, on, and suddenly it didn't make sense at all. I looked at this other girl and I thought, this damn silly sentiment that is. I'd lay me down to D for this Scottish girl. And it suddenly seemed sickly and sweet and cloyed the palate. And that was the moment, I reckon, that I became a man. And looking back, it was really that moment in time when Bonnie Ann Cloyd...
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden just wins the contest of the two stories, and his team, that is Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, win the entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. Thank you.